Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, exploring the cultures of consciousness. And one of my upcoming explorations will be at Lightning in a Bottle. It'll be my first time at Lightning in a Bottle. This getting lots of good word about this West Coast electronic music, neo-tribal, mystical, whatever festival. I haven't been to a festival in 5 years. I used to go a couple times a year to Burning Man and other things, and so I'm very excited about it. And I will be part of a zone called The Village, and they'll be doing a lot of pretty handy craft stuff there, permaculture workshops, stuff about the environment, living in collective life, and they'll be sort of modeling a kind of tribal existence. And that's actually one of the interesting issues that's coming up with some of these festivals now, is exactly how to negotiate the line between respectful acceptance and embrace of certain ideas from indigenous cultures, and at what point does it turn into appropriation, parody, and even cruelty. There has been a general request sent out, I'm not sure by whom involved with the festival, for people not to wear feather headdresses, for example, which is a very interesting one, because even if we can accept why people of European descent may choose to wear Indian jewelry, things they get from crafters, items that they've gotten from their own spirit journeys in the jungle, there are also certain lines that we all sense, even if it's hard to exactly articulate. And I think we'll be talking a little bit about that today. I will be at the Village discussing the new animism. I think it's called the Whole World is Alive. And I'm very interested in both in indigenous worldviews, but also in the growing chorus of anthropologists that are coming up with new, more Western scientific theoretical ways of describing the animist worldview in a way that is not pejorative. And in fact, that term used to be kind of pejorative, at least inside scholarship, was seen as sort of an old idea and kind of unclear. And it's really gotten quite a lot of attention lately, and there's a whole sort of return to the validity of looking at the world as a world that's not just alive in some general abstract sense, but is a world of persons with whom we have relationships, which in some ways is one of the essential dimensions of many indigenous world views. And I'm fascinated to take that idea and not only see how it changes our relationship to plants, to animals, to ecosystems, but also to our human lives and the objects that we craft in human context, which is also part of indigenous animism. It's not just that the rock can be alive, it's also that the pot can be alive. And I'm very curious to see how all of this will go as we plunge into a world of ever more uncanny and somewhat animated objects and technologies, as well as a world of plants, trees, and critters that are in some ways crying, in many ways crying out at this moment of just tremendous ecological transformation and terror. So, with all that said, I'm very happy we have a perfect guest to talk about some of these issues today. Kathleen Harrison has been an ethnobotanist and a studier both of plant medicines and the people who have used them traditionally and continue to use them and grow them and nurture them and care for them today. And she's been doing this for decades and decades, and I've been wanting to have her on the show for a very long time, and I'm really happy it worked out. But before we bring Kathleen onto the show, our co-host here on Expanding Mind, Maja Dau. Hi, Maja.
Hi, Eric. How's it going?
It's going pretty good. I bet you're not going to Lightning in a Bottle.
You know what? I was totally invited to go, but unfortunately, I wasn't going to receive hardly any money, and there's no lodging. So, sadly, because I don't have any camping gear or equipment, I'm unable to attend because I would be having to sleep in the dirt and be kind of homeless. So,
they wouldn't manifest gear for you?
No, I couldn't get anything. They were just like, well, you can come and talk if you want. Good luck.
Yeah, so, yeah. No, I've spoken at many festivals, and I've had the wide range. I was taking – one time I went to Boom, and I was totally taken care of, and they had an offsite house we stayed in, and they had shuttle service. It was beautiful. And then there was other times that were more like, oh yeah, I think there's a sleeping bag over here. Hey,
right. I'm too old.
Hey, Rainbow,
for that,
do you
dude.
Got that sleeping bag?
I can't do it. I need like a toilet and a bed.
That's totally understandable. So I think you should feel totally fine about that. And keep them wanting more.
Exactly.
But let's bring Kat onto the show. Kat, so thanks for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Well, hi, and thank you very much for inviting me.
Yeah, this is great. As I said, I've been really looking forward to bringing you onto the show because a lot of the topics we cover are things you've been thinking about and writing about and researching for such a long time. And I'm really interested in hearing both your ideas and how you've come to see this world, particularly this question of personhood, of animism, of the life and personality even of plants in your own experience, how that's changed, but also how it's how you've seen that worldview changing, over the time that you've been working with these plants and understanding them. So I guess one question I was thinking where to start was, when in your own life did you first sort of encounter the full idea that plants were persons, or plants could be seen as spirits with their own character and that required a kind of relationship that went beyond just cultivating the material plant, knowing how to use it for medicinal purposes, etc., where there was that extra element of kind of encounter in the traditional way of using?
Well, I didn't really encounter it through a tradition, and I encountered it in stages, basically, of understanding and then moving deeper and then understanding it was yet deeper again. And I have to say, I mean, I grew up pretty based in nature and with the childlike sense of the magic possibilities in being in the natural world, and so I was lucky in that way to be sort of open to it. But then I think the first big step into, is this a being? Am I now communicating with this being? Was with Psilocybe cubensis when it became available in 1975, because suddenly so many people were able to grow it. And so the magic mushroom was the first deep engagement where I thought, I'm working with some kind of person, some kind of being that has a sense of itself and its role and is seeking relationship just as I am. And I already had traveled a great deal and been around indigenous people, not calling myself an ethnobotanist yet. And so this... So I didn't really have a cultural or ceremonial context for that realization. It was from direct experience. But then within a year, I was in the Amazon for several months with my former partner, Terrence McKenna, and another friend. And we really... immersed ourselves in living with a small group of mixed indigenous people and a few mestizos and understanding and learning both how to find the plants, the wild ones in the forest that went into ayahuasca, what the other plants in their kind of medicine kit are, you know, not just ayahuasca ones, but all the others, the idea of songs, plants having a song, plants making things happen, and as well as the, you know, folk technology of selecting which plants go together, brewing them, and creating ceremony. And yet there was another really big step that I remember was just sort of like a jolt to my worldview that took me in deeper, and that was in the early 90s when I went back to the Amazon on my own and spent a couple of months doing research and working with people that collected all sorts of plants and setting up a botanical garden in the forest. And it was then, it was in the daily walking on the narrow trails with people who were not literate but fantastic storytellers and who just noticed little tiny things about either the behavior of insects or other creatures or plants or me and what I turned toward, what I responded to, which sounds or smells sort of seemed to awaken me another level. And they, particularly one tiny little old grandmother, just said, that's communication. That is happening all the time. That is what you need to pay attention to. Nothing you're looking for, but actually what comes to you unbidden, accidental. And you need to cultivate the intuition to and trust in yourself to be able to hear that and to respond to it.
Wow, that's such a wonderful set of things you've already set out. I wanted to go back just to the beginning with your first experience on with the mushrooms. Was it? I can only imagine that, especially at that time, even though there had already been this thriving psychedelic culture, more focused on LSD or mescaline, even some peyote in the background. But there still really wasn't a very widespread idea among Americans that the plant could be ensouled, that it could have a kind of character, that it could have a voice. That was not as widespread as sort of, ideas of other planes or melting into oneness and these other kinds of ideas and experiences that people were having. So I'm really kind of curious about that first moment when you're like, wow, I'm not just in an altered state. I'm not just in a psychedelic experience. But there's something here. There's a presence here. And there must have been very both shocking and marvelous and strange and wonderful. And because it, in some ways that was sort of there was an innocence there. You weren't that familiar with these stories. Yeah, you were, but it's still a personal experience. What was that like? What did it remind you of? Was it like childhood? Was it something altogether new? Was it weirdly familiar?
It was like childhood in the sense that, especially in my dreams in my childhood, in literally sleeping dreams, I did sometimes have, as I think children do, or maybe all of us do sometimes, the sense that I was temporarily inhabited by someone else or something else or just felt really significantly different. And I'd had some very instructive dreams as a child that introduced me to that feeling, and I remember thinking, "Oh, it feels like that." That is where that sense that there's something else speaking to you. But in a way, the sense I had at the beginning there with mushrooms was that they were thrilled. It was thrilled to be in a body, moving, seeing, tasting, talking, and. And so it was the sense that the mushroom was experiencing me as much as I was experiencing the mushroom.
Wow, that's remarkable. And then you were talking about the message from the grandmother you met, saying, that's that communication, that kind of intuitive relationship that can be cultivated, that goes beyond just understanding what the folklore is, or even understanding how in these extraordinary experiences where you can't deny that there's some sort of experience or phenomena of encounter and a relationship that's emerging because there's just nothing else, there's no other way to describe it or experience it. But there's something else that you were talking about in this sort of deeper shift that you've gone into in terms of cultivating that intuition. And I ask this partly personally. I'm not a green thumb. I know a lot of people who are really, really deep plant people, and I love being around plant people. And there's a different quality to their character often that I notice, because partly I love it, and I would like to cultivate it, even though I don't really have the means or the temperament particularly, beyond a very sort of low level. There are some, you know, plants in my household that are very significant to me and that I feel like there's some kind of connection. But I'm aware of that, or being in nature, where there is this sort of like possibility of some intuitive sense that there's some kind of connection or some kind of possible relationship with all of these with these plants. And that, but there, I'm a Western guy. I'm like, oh, come on, you're just projecting. It's just a story. I mean, isn't it? It's great if you grow up in a culture where they do this, but come on, I mean, you're just da da da. So there's some sort of resistance, of course, to this sense of intuition as well. And I mean, you're a plant person. You were probably signed up from the time you were a kid on some level. But talk a little bit more about that, what that meant for you to cultivate that kind of intuition and the challenges of that path.
Well, it was when I really, really understood that everything was murmuring and listening, and that all species are equal and they're all equally, not all equally noisy. We are a particularly noisy non-listening species, I think, but but communicating in some way, subtle to strong and ever-changing and all of that. When I really understood that, it was pretty ground-shaking. I mean, for quite a number of months back in the States, I just walking on my normal walks and in my own garden and in the woods, I was both enchanted but also cautious, because I think one of the guidelines that I've always tried to follow, even in my psychedelic life and my ceremonial life, is to have what, I mean, it sounds funny, but what I think of as good taste, like have discernment about, just as you just mentioned, what is projection, what is imitation, what is wishful thinking, and what is really happening, and how do we have a filter, a permeable filter, to take in some kind of communication from the rest of nature and remember that we are that too, and we are also communicating through that permeable membrane, but at the same time, not be making it up, being theatrical, falling for nonsense. And, you know, nature, and if you believe in a spirit world, you're not just talking about the spirits of plants. I mean, indigenous people I've worked with believe in all sorts of spirits that are going on and active all the time. And so it's a very busy, busy cosmology.
Well, let's talk about that for a moment, because I think that mm-hmm. could be one of the more important delineating factors in a lot of human beings' lives, is that ability for discernment, because, I mean, yes, that's not a joke. Like you say, there's all these talks in religions and philosophies about being able to, like, get to that point of discernment where we can recognize truth versus illusion, right? That's a big mm-hmm. factor. So maybe, I mean, in your experience, was there ways you found you could arrive at discernment easier, or is that something that shifts for every individual, or is there some kind of, maybe like, I know it's hard, but maybe like a succinct idea you could offer to help people to get to closer to being able to discern a little better?
Yes, well, you're right. It's a very important sort of survival skill, or spiritual mental survival skill, to have that and to cultivate it, and we're not good at it at all in our culture. But I would say that the best tool for having that is having really cultivated your own self-awareness. Mm. So So if you are aware, if you can be both engaged and aware of your engagement or self-observing at the same time, which is a kind of, you know, yoga, but it's really, really useful, and I feel it's a way of being in the world that is both rich and fascinating and safer from illusion and from heading down a side path that's, you know, just going to be weird or not helpful or harmful. And I know you want to talk about the contemporary scene and I think we should. But I'm kind of reaching here. Let's see. There's an observer. We each have an observer. We can use that observer. We can engage that observer and carry her, him, with each of us as we go, so that we, I think that's what helps that discernment. I think that that's what helps you to both be using your mental faculties and your skeptical and thoughtful definitions and tools, but also be working from that other center, what many Native people call, you know, the other mind, which is more in the solar plexus, which is a sense of what's real and what's safe, or is this the way I should go? Should I trust that person? Is this plant good for me? Are my friends are saying to do this, but is that really my path? You know, there's this observer that works in our bodies as well as in our minds that is very, very useful if you can become aware of it and tune it and use it whenever you're given these choices, which are constant. It's kind of a huge topic that we could talk about.
But it's a very difficult one, and it really because it's so difficult, I think often people who do realize that there is a need to develop this discernment, that there's not really a net, you know, there's not a clear thing like a scientific study that's going to be able to objectively prove where you're projecting or where you're imitating and where something is happening. And that's part of why it's sort of an esoteric path. But because it's so difficult to talk about, I feel like people often do develop these skills as they age, as they stick with things, as they make mistakes, as they see other people making mistakes. But because we don't have a shared language for it, or the language that we have for it are often languages that are taken from more indigenous styles, sometimes artfully and sometimes not artfully, that there's sort of a gap in our own language. And by our, I mean, people raised in American society who probably don't have the opportunity to really, plunge into an indigenous life way or spend a lot of time in environments where they're really learning in a full-bodied, full-dimensional, cultural, psychological, spiritual way what it means to live within a more indigenous frame of mind, or even a mestizo frame of mind for that matter. But it's so important to talk about. So I really appreciate that it is a path, and it is a path that isn't going to be rewarded with a clear signal a lot of the time, and you have to wrestle with doubt. And that's part of what's difficult about that discernment. And I see this a lot in spiritual people and people in psychedelic culture and in all sort of domains where there's some kind of spiritual pursuit, is that unless you cultivate a certain kind of, what we call it, doubt or skepticism or questioning or discernment that is willing to, you know, wield a sword, that it's going to be very difficult to avoid a lot of excessive projection or delusion or whatever we want to call it, and that becomes part of the path itself. And so you have to kind of make friends with that side of you, as opposed to, I think, a lot of people growing up in a very disenchanted society, and they see what the macro results of this disenchantment look like in whatever crass consumer culture and our attitude towards the environment, you know, the great catastrophe, that when they see there's another way of being that involves a kind of that involves a spiritual dimension or an imaginal dimension in the deep sense of imagination, they're just like, let's go. And, you don't get to go the whole way. Or if you do, it's probably, you're gonna be running some risks. So I really appreciate you even making a stab, at that thing. But I think that to bring it back to the plants, that one of the ways in my life that I feel like I've been able to do this is to cultivate relationships with plants that are subtle in their effects, that have a little bit of personality. They're not going to hit you over the head. They're not going to tell you that this is, the be-all, end-all, the cosmic, secret. But yet there's some kind of relationship. And I know that you did a workshop recently on talking about specific plants, and including tobacco and other more sort of, tobacco is a huge, profoundly shamanic and very powerful plant, but it's also something that people don't necessarily think of in the West as being, a heavy duty, character. There are some ways in which we have opportunities, throughout our day, in some sense, to cultivate some of these kinds of relationships.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes. I mean, you just touched on a number of different things there, but that I appreciate. And I, before addressing tobacco at all, I would say that subtlety is really a great teacher, and that for people who want to jump, 100% on the bandwagon and get into the psychedelic plants or get into the ayahuasca scene or whatever, it is the self-awareness, cultivating that, cultivating your observer, and cultivating your relationships to subtler species is a really good training for that. So it might just be, something that volunteers even in your garden, or something that you've kept around for years, kept a potted plant going and not really thought of it as communicating in some way. I mean, it's so tricky. The thing that I think is kind of perilous for people making this transition, because what we're talking about really is a shift in worldviews, where people from our embattled culture, where we are both reduced to thinking that only matter is real, and at the same time, so powerful and so prone to illusion, and so then people discover, oh, there's another way of being in the world, another way of seeing. I'll just adopt the whole thing all at once, but they don't really know what it is that they're adopting, because you can't learn it in a minute or an evening. And so a lot of projection, a lot of wishful thinking, a lot of just that sense, that people have taken on that, oh, okay, maybe the universe is alive after all. Maybe the earth is alive. And even if they don't go into the details of like each species is alive, or ancestors or rocks or whatever it may be, are speaking, even if they don't go that far at first, I find that one of the perils is that people become passive once they think the universe has a will. And, we've all heard it so many times. Oh, okay, that must be good because the universe must have wanted it to happen, or, it was meant to be. And that passivity, I think, is dangerous, and kind of like the instant adopter of something without knowing what it is you're adopting. I hope I'm not going too far from what you're talking about.
No. That makes a tremendous amount of sense, and that is a and again, it's that reason in the broad sense, not like necessarily rationality as just like a limited system of logic, but just reason in general. That's part of our spiritual life. Reason is part of our relationships with the world and with these different kinds of dimensions. And it seems to me that if you study indigenous cultures and indigenous leaders, you read texts, you read anthropology, you meet people, etc., that it's very clear that that's part of the indigenous worldview. It's just one that it's not as glowing and magical as the stories, and like, oh, these things, this whole new world. But if you actually look at how people are behaving, they also are in different worlds of just got to get by, got to deal with the practical situations at hand, dealing with politics, with the people and that you have to work with, and all of that. And at the same time, there are all these other dimensions as well. But I want you to talk more on this matter and also maybe tobacco. But we have to take a break right now. We're listening to you're listening to Expanding Mind. We're talking with Kathleen Harrison about a living world, and we'll be right back after this message.
Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. This is Maja Daou. We're here with Eric Davis, and we are speaking with Kathleen Harrison about a living world and becoming alive and all kinds of fun stuff. So before the break, there was a lot of discussion about kind of indigenous cultures and how they can kind of get at some of this information a little more naturally, or they seem to just kind of be that way, more like the indigenous people just are that way, and then Western people seem to be this other way. So there seems to be this thing that happens where now we're like separating it out, right? There's this wall, like you're either indigenous or you're not. And if you're not, you have to go to these indigenous places and relearn all this stuff. And you can't really, like, because we've kind of like destroyed and murdered most indigenous cultures, it's taboo to appropriate those things, like Eric was saying with the headdress thing. Although, I don't know, maybe if we just required everyone to wear them, maybe, like, we'd get closer instead of just making all these rules and taboos, like, you can't do this, you can't do that. And maybe if, like, indigenous people rode in cars, that would be the same thing. But I don't know, it all gets a little weird. So in your experience, being able to kind of go and be immersed in an indigenous culture versus kind of, like, what we would call a Western culture, did you notice kind of like what do the indigenous people necessarily do that's so different? Is it more just like a mindset, like a perspective that maybe, like you said, is more about seeing everything as alive and participating, whereas, you know, Westerners just don't do that? Is it really kind of that simple, like just a way of seeing and being? Is that the only difference? Or did you see any other kind of big indicators of like kind of the big separators between Westerners and indigenous cultures?
Well, hi, Maja. I think it is really a big fundamental difference in worldview. I think it's just, you know, what do you think is real, and what is possible within that reality that you recognize. I have lots of compassion for indigenous people, of course, and I think we have to place ourselves in history, and we have to think about that history in order to understand this question, because this is a post-colonial world. We're participating in these ceremonies with indigenous people, and in some cases taking their, you know, most powerful agents and psychedelics and all of that, learning from people who, as you mentioned, have been in the last, you know, handful of centuries, devastated and reduced often to just 10% of who was here before, and the way of life they've got will never be the same, and all of that, and yet they've held on to this worldview to some extent. Not everybody has, but many have. They've held on to it, but it's had to accommodate greater tragedy than we can even imagine. But on the other hand, and so I should finish by saying that that's in the worldview. That's in the medicine, too. You know, that if you don't spend part of every time you're engaged in that relationship, whether you're in a ceremony or you're, you know, visiting another culture, or you're taking one of these powerful medicines, not even with Native people, but if you just spend part of your time looking back at history, it's one big story that's been replicated all over the place, not just in the Americas. And on the other hand, the flip side of that is all of us have indigenous ancestors. We all have it in our, whatever you want to call it, in our DNA, in our genetic memory, in our deeper, farther back mythologies or songs that our ancestors related to nature in much the same way. Everybody did for so long, for most of human history, in order to effectively live in the world, in a world of nature. And we've lost that in, you know, the age of reason, the age of imperialism, the age of stuff, you know, all of the things that we're in. And we actually, basically right now, I think we treat technology as the most animate engagement that we have with the world, if I'm generalizing about Western culture.
Yeah, that's really true. I mean, it's almost like if people can accept their technology as a living thing more than they can almost plant sometimes, it seems like, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like almost
mm-hmm.
more willing to accept they had some kind of synchronistic experience on Facebook rather than they could in the forest.
But so for that reason, because we are so, you know, divorced from our roots, especially in North America, we've all of us except Native Americans have moved here from somewhere else. We've mingled, we've let go of our roots, we barely know how many different nationalities we are, and we don't know much about those, the belief systems of the place that we came from, or the many places that an individual's ancestors came from, and we've mixed it up. So we're hungry, even if we don't know it. You know, we're hungry for revitalization. Cultural revitalization can happen here.
Do you think it would be a positive thing if we started appropriating indigenous cultures as more like maybe trying to get that worldview out instead of, you know, just appropriating it, more like learning from it and integrating it and trying to get it more? Like, how would be a way to sort of infiltrate this kind of worldview into popular culture without being appropriative, but doing it in a more kind of conscious way where we could positively spread the worldview that wasn't in a sort of commodified Coachella-y sort of way?
Mm-hmm.
Would it just be through the plant engagement, or what are people's options to kind of engage with it without being jerks to indigenous people?
Well, I think we're both individuals in a collective, and I think a lot of the work really has to start on the individual or very small collective level, and it has to do with our daily practices of how we relate to whatever is in our life around us. Or, you know, it always helps, I think, to go for a walk in nature or just go to the park. Or sometimes I tell my students, if you're, you know, all tangled up in, I don't know, anger or hurt or self-obsession of some sort, you know, just go take a really, really good look at a leaf. Spend 2 minutes looking at a single leaf. It doesn't matter what it is. And just, like, move out of yourself into the details of that, how the flow in that, and the consciousness of remembering that there's something beside you. And I think that could happen much more as a beginning, because not everyone can garden. Everyone could, you know, go to a park probably or walk in the woods somewhere. But and then just sort of have trust that actually the knowledge of how to relate, much of it just silent. It doesn't have to be big and showy, just silent in your own daily practice. How to do that, cultivate that, and be aware that somewhere in your ancestry, you have these connections too. So you don't, even though we've learned to look for them by learning about or experiencing, sharing company with contemporary indigenous peoples, it's not the only source of that knowledge. It is actually, if we can dream and we can take notions from our dreams, and if we can meditate and we can let different things arise, then we can also draw on that knowledge that is somewhere in us. But we have to practice it. It's not going to happen sitting in your office just thinking about it, you know. So I suggest small daily practices of awareness of nature, listening to birdsong, whatever it may be, you know, and allowing that you are not completely other. And we're not Martians. We're just human beings who lost our traditions, and our traditions included this way of being.
Yeah, that's very well said.
So, you know, if part of the goal on the larger level here, it's not just that individuals are each seeking connection, it's that we have the potential to undergo cultural revitalization, even though we're sort of a culture like a soup of many different ones that have woven together, but we have the potential to be more awake and more aware and more engaged. And the crisis that we're in, the, you know, overall climate and all the other aspects of the crisis, kind of, I think, force the question. So it's not just that individuals are feeling this isn't enough, I need to go find, you know, a big experience and other kind of people to imitate, but it's that really, you know, we are being called on to wake up more in order to engage and help in whatever way we can. Maybe
absolutely.
Not turn.
Well, you know, one thing you mentioned before, you talked about how crowded, in a way, the world of spirits is. You know, there's ancestors, there's the rocks, there's the objects, there's the plants, there's the animals. It's a very full world of lots of different kinds of perspectives. And that's one of the interesting things, or one of the ways in which people thinking not necessarily in a spiritual or even anthropological way about problems in the world or the condition of living in our moment with all the things happening. One of the reasons that animism starts to make sense, because in a way we're in a world where agency, decision, choice is distributed so widely among humans, institutions, technologies, plants, ecosystems, and we're aware that there's no master, you know, even though we thought we were the master, there's all of these processes that are kind of have their own say, and that this sort of, you know, crowded world that we're in is also the crowded world in some sense of spirit mm-hmm. that's distributed through all of these different sorts of agents and characters and objects. So I think that it's really it is a larger call, and it is more than just, you know, it's so easy when we get into these things to sort of talk about the individual path and the sort of spiritual homelessness and finding a path yourself. But there really is a very strong collective dimension to this. And then one other thing I wanted to ask you about in terms of this relationship and you know, to some degree the call of an indigenous worldview, because there's also, of course, tons of mestizos, and mm-hmm. in many ways the mestizo is almost a better model, because we are not, you know, coming from an even, you know, largely intact kind of traditional frame the way that some groups in the Amazon still are, even though they're, of course, already mixed themselves. They've been forced to by history, by technology, et cetera, et cetera. But the life of the worldview of the mestizo, where you're already mixed, in yeah. a way, is almost more like where we're at. And that mixture, the fact that we're also always going to be Western people and people who are drawn towards opening up to these new different kinds of conversations and mixing the way that, it, you know, in the Amazon and Brazil, there have been these extraordinary mixtures of cultures, of religious traditions, that the mixture is also part of what we're seeking. It's not just the purity of a single culture's view of the world. It's a kind of a sort of mixture that the spirits are invited to, as well as the technologies and the historical objects and all the other things that we also have to pay attention to. Does that make sense, or am I just kind of riffing here?
No, I think it does. I think it does. And I mean, mestizo culture, the mix of Spanish and Indian, or Portuguese and Indian in Latin America, is complicated, stratified, you know, has all sorts of shadows of class and racial problems, all sorts of things. But it also is, as you say, a blend. And, you know, one of the things that I most admire about indigenous people of the Americas is their incredible and ongoing adaptation to situations so much bigger than they are, and yet there's some kind of like impulse to keep going and to hold steady in some way to these to these ways of being in the world, even if what appears to be all around you has completely changed. And I think that's come through a lot of the mestizo culture. I've worked a lot in Mexico and with Mazatec people, especially over the last 25 years, and watched mestizoization happening, meaning people coming down out of the mountains and out of their old ways and into the towns and cities to get jobs, and how much of their, you know, what might be called, in quotation marks, magical worldview survives that transition from one generation to the next. Even over just 25 years, I've been able to see a lot of changes. And some of them are very sad. I mean, languages get diluted and all sorts of things disappear. But other things arise and get braided together. So you're absolutely right that there is a kind of a braided belief system that then arises and carries on and will change again because it's all adaptation. So we're in that role too. We have been blending our, you know, Anglo, Asian, Russian, African roots and all of this in this country for a long time. And we have this, and people that come out of those blendings are always seeking new ways to be together and new ways to be in the world together. And I think that we are evolving. I have to console myself, I have to say, because having spent 40 years in the field, things that I remember 40 years ago that are just gone, or 25 years ago that are gone and going, it's really sad to me. It's like it's the loss of biodiversity. It's the loss of cultural and linguistic diversity. And, you know, they're like songs that will never, ever be sung again. But new things are arising, and this is how nature works, and we are nature. And you know, even our thoughts. And I sometimes have to remind myself, I wobble in my balance, you know, with these elements, that there's a motivating spirit that's running through everything, and it takes many, many forms and endless manifestations, whether it's life forms or even idea forms, thought forms, and that in some sense that spirit, and it doesn't mean it's all good. It's that phrase actually sets me off. It's not all good. Nothing is all good, but it's complex and beautiful and always changing, and even with the suffering in it, you know. I hope that's just not too big. I just went really big, but
no. I appreciate it because I mean, frankly, I wrestle with despair in the world a lot, and I'm always it's always important for me when I hear people who clearly, authentically and genuinely find themselves in a place where they can recognize the suffering, but also see it as in a complex, lively framework that pulls out of the ruts that we can get into in terms of just seeing the tragedy or the tremendous suffering of our moment. And that sounds to me also like plant wisdom. It's something that also seems to be part of the message of the plant worlds, which from my perspective have never been all golden and filled with light and gushy heavenly spaces for more than a few moments, that there's plenty of darkness in the big picture as well. And that always seemed to me one of the most important parts of these encounters is a really full dimensional world. We only have a couple of minutes here, and I have to say, I hope I'm not putting you on the spot, but I really hope you're writing a book. Are you writing a book, Kat?
I have been writing a lot, and I know I have not published very much for how much experience I've been given as like a gift in this world, but I have been writing a lot, and it seems to be pulling together into a book. Yes.
And you know, how about illustrating? I know that. I mean, I will never forget the first time I saw your illustrations in, you know, the classic Underground Magic Mushroom Grower's Guide, and and those sort of impish but playful and still very technically accurate images of mushrooms will is part of my sort of, you know, a visual lexicon. Is illustration still a part of your practice?
It is. It's been not as active recently, but yes, it does continue. Yes.
Well, good. I hope that becomes part of the whatever texts will pull out of you. Consider me part, you know, like a representative of your superego for a moment, going, write the book.
Thank you very much.
Any other? I know you just did this workshop. Anything else coming up this year that you might want to tell people about?
Yes. Well, I've begun teaching in the North Bay, Northern area, Sonoma County, north of San Francisco, and as well as traveling. But here I love to teach this four-month series called Global Ethnobotany with a local focus. And it goes from the from biology to history to, you know, the marvelous ways that people use plants all over the world and specifically in this region, and then into these big plant spirit questions and shamanism and all of that too. So I love that. And then I am going to teach another round of the big botanical beings that's kind of about the personification of these big medicine plants.
Great. Well, okay, Kathleen, thanks for being with us on Expanding Mind.
Uh-huh. Thank you very much. I enjoyed it.
And folks, you can always go to botanicaldimensions.org to find out more information. So for me and Majid Ali out there, keep your minds open.